With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. So, James, you think Emerson captured the epicness of Lexington and Concord? Was it as epic as you think he painted it?
Well, in hindsight, yes, it certainly was. And even at the time, people realized, okay, things just got ugly. This is the first time we've had a real exchange of fire between colonists and British regular troops. You know, you'd had the Boston Massacre, but anyway, it's not really a massacre. Five or six people were killed, but that was just the British firing into a crowd. But here now you have colonials firing back. We had had for 10 years, going all the way back to the Stamp Act, we'd had a lot of kind of a propaganda war going on. You know, we'd had a lot of protests, a lot of letters being sent, a lot of pamphlets being printed in America, but we hadn't got to the point of armed conflict yet. So I think even at the time, well, I know even at the time, people realized, okay, it's getting serious now. this is not a good thing. We're having some people thought it was a good thing, but we're going to see this has a galvanizing effect on a lot of people. However, it is not the point of no return. In hindsight, we look at this as the beginning of the American Revolutionary War. But at the time, nobody thought, okay, well, this is going to be a huge war that's going to last for years and years, and tens of thousands of people will be killed. It was not seen as that climatic of an event. So the answer to your question, I'm kind of being a weasel here, but yes and no. I'm being a politician.
Yeah, it's sort of like what Frodo Baggins says about the elves. Do not go to the elves for wisdom, for they will give you both yes and no as an answer. And this is really the act of a historian. Clear-cut answers are never really that clear-cut. And I think this gives us a chance to look at the American Revolution through the eyes of the colonists and the British themselves. They didn't know what direction this was going. Many of them didn't assume total war or independence. Maybe some dreamed of it, but many others simply thought, let's keep the status quo, but turn it into something that's just a little bit better for ourselves. For colonists, that would mean no taxation. For the British, that would mean more taxation to fund the empire. One aspect of the shot heard around the world that I think is accurate, I don't know if Emerson intended it, but when he talked about the shot heard around the world and the reverberations, he keyed into the unique culture of American media and American sensationalism and journalism. And I'm glad to say that it was right there at the beginning. So one founding father that we really only know of because of his beer, Samuel Adams, he's, I think, underrated. He was very important as a newsmaker and some would say a propagandist. And he really has impact here after Lexington and Concord. So what Adams did was produce a fictitious and very inflammatory account of British behavior during the expedition. And you can go back to the previous episode to hear about that. But what he described was women being pulled from their beds and driven naked through the streets, and men are being butchered without mercy, and poor people, the colonists, are just being exploited left and right by the cruel British. His account makes it to London quickly. General Gage, he didn't know about the Adams report, so he produced his own account that was pretty neutral. He just says that casualties were heavy on both sides. He just wants to give an accounting of what happened. So Gage's reports didn't do anything to counter Adams' allegations, and this shocks people in Britain. There's actually money raised in England to aid American wounded and widows and orphans. The British are already losing the propaganda war, so there's American journalism right there at the very beginning, ready to spin things the way it needs to go. But we're not going to keep dwelling on Lexington and Concord. We're going to get into Bunker Hill. So, James, set things up for us. What's happening in the colonies at this point?
Okay, so before we get to the battle, let's talk about a few developments that are going on in between Lexington and Concord and the actual Battle of Bunker Hill. So after the conflict at Lexington and Concord, again, it's kind of, to call those battles is really kind of over-glorifying it, especially Lexington, but the colonists begin to divide into loyalists, and loyalists wanted to remain a part of Great Britain. Even some of the people who had been protesting were loyalists. They had no conception or no desire whatever of being independent from Great Britain. They wanted to stay part of Great Britain, but they just wanted their rights. They wanted, as you mentioned earlier, the taxes to be reduced. They wanted the power to govern their own affairs to be restored. But you also have patriots, and again, the word patriot is a loaded term. When you think of somebody who's a patriot, you think of them as a good guy, right? You think of them as somebody who is loyal to their country, or you think of the football team. Boo. Anyway, sorry, Boston people, if you're listening. But anyway, we're going to use the term as just a technical term for somebody who wanted independence. We'll use it sometimes. We'll use it synonymously with Americans or with even with colonists. Although those terms, they're not all exactly the same. There's some overlap, but a patriot, as we use it, will be somebody who wants independence. And at first, there's not really that many people that wanted independence, but the number is going to grow as developments unfold. New England militiamen had closed off the port of Boston to British ships, and they're gradually beginning to surround the city of Boston. We talked about that previously, how in 1775, Boston was almost an island. I guess it bears repeating, Scott, that it was shaped, I use the analogy like a ping pong paddle, although it's not a perfectly round ping pong paddle. It's a ping pong paddle that the Cookie Monster took a bite out of or something. Cookie, oh, not cookie. But anyway, sorry. Yes, I did have little kids at one time.
Yeah, I know the C is anyway, for cookie song. So, it's all good.
Yeah, me too. Mine grew up though, Scott. But anyway, so the Boston is on this ping pong paddle like piece of land, and it's connected to the mainland just in one place, which is like the handle of the paddle. It's a neck, and then it's surrounded on land on about, if you think of 360 degrees, it was probably about more than half of that, 200 degrees to 270, not to get too mathematical there. But anyway, so the British in Boston are beginning to feel a little bit hemmed in. Now, meanwhile, on May 10th, 1775, another very important development occurs, and that is the meeting of the Second Continental Congress. We had talked about the First Continental Congress before, which met in 1774, but that one only met for a brief time and then dissolved. And they, one of the last things they agreed was to meet again in May of the next year, that would be 1775, to survey the situation and to see what needed to be done. Well, they had no idea back in 1774 that there would be bloodshed on both sides. So now the Second Continental Congress has a big job to do. What are we going to do? How are we going to handle this situation with conflict breaking out, armed conflict in some places, British soldiers coming over and all that? What are we going to do? And this Continental Congress, I will go ahead and just say this, this Congress is actually never going to dissolve until they are relieved later by the Confederation Congress, but more on that in the future. So the Second Continental Congress that begins meeting in May 10th of 1775, they are essentially going to be the American government for the next several years. And this first group that met as the Second Continental Congress, and by the way, the membership of this Congress is going to constantly vary. People will go home, new people will come to replace them. But this first meeting, this is kind of like a who's who of founding fathers or an all-star team, the dream team. It's got Benjamin Franklin, it's got George Washington, it's got Thomas Jefferson, it's got Jefferson may have come a little bit later. I'm maybe a little fuzzy. I can't remember things like I used to, but it will have Jefferson before long. It's going to have John Adams, Samuel Adams, and a lot of other people that if I said their name, people would recognize them. They meet in Philadelphia, just as the first one had, and they meet in the old State House, which we now call Independence Hall. And when they met, the battle at Lexington and Concord was less than a month old. Now, within this Congress, some representatives, for example, John Adams and Samuel Adams, they wanted to declare independence from Britain. They were ready to cut the cord. Let's go independent now. But at this time, the majority did not want this. Although a lot of them, their opinions are going to change very quickly, relatively quickly, like within a year, give or take. So that's the Second Continental Congress. Do you want to add anything, Scott?
We've mentioned this before, but it's similar to the Civil War, where the drive for emancipation doesn't become universal until much later in the war due to other things that are happening, some of them culturally, some of them politically. There's a definite movement there. And like you, those who were patriots, it was pretty small. I think it was something like 30%. I don't know what time of the war, but don't think of World War II where all of society is mobilized for one common cause. It's very different. But something else before Bunker Hill, I know you're going to touch on Fort Ticonderoga, but as you go through this, here's something I'm curious about. Things are very chaotic in the formation of the nascent, not even existent, United States. Washington was named the head of the army. Was anyone directing Fort Ticonderoga? Did it just happen? Is this a headless monster, the U.S. military? What's going on?
Yeah, let me touch on that. I'll first introduce it by saying that Fort Ticonderoga was a British fort. It was in upstate New York, and it was near Lake Champlain. It was lightly guarded at this time, and it was in a state of disrepair. And so you're saying the question was, who was in charge? Well, there were actually two different groups that kind of at the same time independently decided, gee, I think I'll take Fort Ticonderoga. That would be, I think we can have it. You know, it's not very well guarded. Why not? Let's give it a shot. And they were led by two different men, both of whom had huge egos. And one of them we're going to talk about a lot throughout the course of this series of podcasts, the other not so much. But so there was a colonial militia group led by Ethan Allen, and they were called the Green Mountain Boys. Ethan Allen, I think he was a colonel in the militia, and he wanted the fort. But there's also a fella named, here we go, Benedict Arnold. Yeah, we should have Benedict Arnold theme music. There you go. Can you remember that, Scott? Just every time I mention that. Or we could have our listeners take a drink. That could be one of cues to throw one back. But anyway, both of these men wanted it, and they came together, and you know, they at first neither one of them was going to give in to the other as far as who's going to be in charge. So they kind of agreed to co-lead the expedition, and they decided, well, we might as well. We want the same thing. We can do better together. So let's work together. And so they do. And they went up to the door and knocked on the front door and said, surrender. And the man said, oh, you wish to surrender to me? Very well, I accept. No, I'm just kidding. That's from the Princess Bride movie. But so anyway, the guy says, okay. So he surrenders to these two militia units, one led by Arnold, one led by Allen. And the important thing is that the capture of the fort gave the colony several cannon. I've 78 in all. The counts are different depending on your source, but roughly 80-ish cannon of different types fall into Patriot hands, and also many other needed supplies as well. And then Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen took control of all of Lake Champlain as far north as Fort St. John at the northern end of the lake. So they're extending their control. Arnold, say what you will about Arnold, but he was a man of adventure. He was a man of action. He liked to do things and to conquer and to take things and to fight. He took 150 men. He captured a 70-ton British sloop at Fort St. John, which is just 20 miles south of Montreal. And he sailed it back to New York. Not bad, huh? And
go ahead. Finish your point and I'll follow up.
I was just going to say Arnold financed most of this campaign out of his own pocket. He was a fairly wealthy merchant by this time from Connecticut. He put forth £1,000, which today would be a lot of money, but back then it was a princely sum, out of his own money to help pay for this campaign. So Arnold and Allen captured the attention, of course, of the powers that be down in Philadelphia, the Second Continental Congress, as well as they get George Washington's attention. And again, at this time, Washington is just one of the representatives in the Continental Congress, but of course, that's going to change pretty soon. So again, we'll hear a lot about Arnold. Arnold's going to have a lot of adventures, a lot of triumphs, a lot of daring do, and he's really probably the most swashbuckling character that we'll see. And I keep thinking of the Princess Bride. I think about the Dread Pirate Roberts, you know, the Man in Black, Wesley. Yeah, kind of like that, I guess, but no mask. And so we'll hear a lot from Arnold. Ethan Allen, not so much. I'll just go ahead and say he goes on to found a really good furniture store and it becomes a nationwide chain later on.
I was going to ask if that's down in Texas. That's what I always think of with Ethan Allen.
Yeah, we have Ethan Allen, but anyway, I'm kidding, listeners. Obviously, he didn't start. It was named after him. But so there you go. So that's Fort Ticonderoga.
Well, at this point, for these different militia companies, what does it look like if you have someone who does have some daring, like an Ethan Allen or a Benedict Arnold, are they just circling around looking for strategic assets or, you know, weak targets that they can take over? They're sort of doing freelance work for the colonial cause, or what is this like right mm-hmm. now? Is anyone directing this?
Well, most of them are not. I mean, most of them, we talked a little bit about militia in one of the previous episodes. Militia were originally founded as kind of like a home guard. You know, their point was to defend the colony against Indian attacks or whatever other kind of attack there might be, the mostly Indian attacks. But now that the British are being snarky and starting to cause trouble, their mission has changed. But at this point, militia, they're beginning to coalesce and get more organized. Their job now is to defend their towns against the British. But if they had a leader who was a swashbuckler like an Arnold or an Allen, both these guys were men of action, they wanted glory. They wanted to serve their country, that for sure, but they also wanted to become famous. They wanted glory. They wanted promotion. And so if they saw something, some ripe fruit, I can't talk, but if they saw something hanging and maybe then they would do it. But that was the exception rather than the rule, Scott. It's not like most militia units were just looking around. Oh, what's the next target we can take? Most of them were defensive in nature, at least.
Okay,
at the beginning.
Well, let's get back to the action and return to our ping pong paddle. So, what's happening around Boston? Hey, everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yes! The ping pong paddle with the bite taken out of it. All right, so Boston. Back to Boston. Boston's going to be kind of the center of action for quite some time here. The Patriot colonial governments appointed commanders who began to organize the militia companies into regiments. So again, we're getting more organized. As we saw, a company typically had 60, 70, 80 men, sometimes as much as 100, but usually 60 or 70. to 80. So they put them together into larger units. A company, this is almost the same as the Civil War, except they're a little smaller. A company is usually commanded by a captain. And then you would put 10 of those together. So if you think 60 men times 10, that's 600. That's a regiment. And a regiment would be commanded by a colonel. But this took time. You know, we're talking about totally different units. They're not designed to work with other people. As I mentioned earlier, they are designed to be defensive and to defend their town or their county against invasion from outside. But now they are beginning to band together and try to get organized and march down toward Boston to put some pressure on the British. And they are totally unprofessional. We'll talk more about that later. We did mention this before, that militia were as much of a social thing as they were a military thing.
Yeah, it's the Elks Lodge that happened to have some muskets around.
Mm-hmm. When I introduced the concept of militia to my students, I always say, well, think of it kind of like the National Guard. These are part-time soldiers, but they are not anywhere near as professional
as
our
National Guard.
No, exactly.
I'm making a point to say
our National Guard today is professional. They're good. You know, they know what to do. They know how to do their jobs. They know how to fire weapons and to march and to fight in organized fashion. But these guys really didn't. So these new colonels, and there'll be some generals appointed too, they begin to try to whip these guys into shape. But like I said, it is like pulling teeth. All right, again, we've talked about the geography of Boston, so I don't need to go over that again. One thing I will mention in addition to what we said about the ping pong paddle is that there was high ground to the southeast on the mainland. This is called the Dorchester Heights. Okay, so very high, looked down upon Boston. Boston was very low. It was just, you know, I don't know if it was exactly sea level, but it was flat. And so you had high ground to the south and to the northwest, which is called the Charlestown Peninsula. More on that soon. The Charlestown Peninsula, I'll say for now, has three hills: Morton's Hill, Breed's Hill, and Bunker Hill. And we're just about to talk more about those. So as the British regular soldiers, the Redcoats, were camped out in Boston, they would look up and they would see these heights and they would think, or at least the commanders would think, I'm sure most of them thought, we cannot let those fall into rebel hands. We've got to control the high ground, because if the rebels were to get men and especially cannon up onto that high ground, they could just fire it right down on us. We'd be sitting ducks. So there's going to be some conflict over this high ground. I'm setting the stage here because I want people to know why the Battle of Bunker Hill occurred. Why did the British choose to attack? Well, they wanted to get control of the high ground. All right, so on May 27th, Massachusetts and New Hampshire militia troops seize Noodles Island, and we'll put a map.
Yeah, these will all be in the show notes
on the website.
Check these out for reference.
Yeah, I found a really good map of Revolutionary era Boston. There's plenty of them out there, but Noodles Island was a little bit to the north and east of Boston, and British troops attempted to retake the island, but the Patriots fought them off. So that doesn't work well for the British. Remember, for the British to capture any of this high ground, they had to go across water. They had to go across the Charles River. So, or on the other side, it was a different body of water, but they're almost completely surrounded by water.
You're looking almost at an amphibious assault.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is obviously is much more complicated than just marching across land. You've got to get plenty of boats lined up. You've got to hurry and get across the water. You got to make sure that the other side doesn't have cannon shooting the crud out of you, things like that. Now the Colonials, or the Patriots, shall we say, they wanted to put artillery pieces on the Dorchester Heights. And again, that would mean Boston would have to be evacuated. But they had almost none. That was the problem. The British chased them off in early June. They occupied the heights themselves, and that left only one area of high ground left to the rebels. By the way, the Dorchester Heights, we're going to talk about them again later, but they're going to be unoccupied by the British eventually, but for now, those are off limits to the Patriots. So we're looking at the Charlestown Peninsula. All right. And let's go ahead and talk about that.
So
did you want to
that means
say anything?
That they have to choose a hill to occupy. I wonder which one it is, you know, this battle happening on a certain hill. Which one is it?
Well, funny you should ask, because the battle is actually misnamed.
Nice.
It's famously known as Bunker Hill. Now, let me do it one of my mental maps, one of my famous by now mental or infamous mental maps. So, so when you are thinking about the Charlestown Peninsula, it's north of Boston. To get from Boston to this peninsula, you have to go across the Charles River. Like you said, it would have to be an amphibious assault. Think of a right triangle, okay? Think of a 45, 45, 90 triangle. Yes, folks, I did used to teach geometry. So you've got this triangle, and the vertex or the 90-degree angle is called Charlestown. That's a little town right in the corner. But north of that, moving toward the hypotenuse of the triangle, you have, and by the way, on the other side of the triangle is the Mystic River. So again, this peninsula is surrounded on three sides by water, kind of like Boston itself, although it's smaller. You have the Mystic River at the north, the Charles River at the bottom, and then Boston Harbor on the other side, which would be the east side. Sorry, the west side is the only side on which it is connected to the land, and that's called the Charlestown Neck. Now, on this Charlestown Peninsula, there are three hills. As I mentioned, there were Morton's Hill, which is on the far east side, or the right, if you're going with my mental map. Think of my 45, 45, 90 triangle with the vertex pointing down closest to Boston. If that doesn't make sense, just pause and grab a real map. Anyway, you're thinking, oh my gosh, I thought this was a history podcast, not math. But then you had it kind of in the center of the peninsula, you have Breed's Hill. And then to the left of the map or the west side, you have Bunker Hill. So the Patriot troops, they're in the overall command of a man named Artemas Ward. And he and the other generals decide to They decided to occupy Bunker Hill in order to have a place from which to fire artillery into Boston. Like I said, let's get some men and some cannon up on this high hill, and then we can pick off the British soldiers like ducks in a row. About 1,200 militiamen moved onto the Charlestown Peninsula. Their job was to go on to Bunker Hill. Bunker Hill is the hill that is furthest to the left on our mental map, or on a regular map, if you're looking at that. It's furthest to the west. It's closest to the mainland. So they're supposed to go up onto Bunker Hill, but instead they just make an executive decision right on the spot, and they decide to continue marching to the east, more onto the middle of the peninsula, onto Breed's Hill. I figure it's closer to Boston. Perhaps that was why they made the decision. It's closer to Charlestown. So they go up to Breed's Hill. And again, that's about 1,200 militiamen. So the battle is actually going to occur on Breed's Hill, and it should technically be called Breed's Hill, but it's been misnamed Bunker Hill since the day, and I'm not going to try to change it myself. Occasionally you'll hear a speaker or a lecturer say, it's the Battle of Breed's Hill. But everybody's like, what? What is that? So we'll call it Bunker Hill, even though the fighting does not occur on Bunker Hill. It's going to occur on Breed's Hill.
It's like the person who says, the name isn't Sacagawea, it's Sacagawea. Sacagawea. And
yeah. Good luck making that stick.
Don't worry, people. We're not going to be that guy.
Once they got onto Breed's Hill, they were commanded by William Prescott, Colonel William Prescott. Prescott decided to construct a redoubt. A redoubt is basically like a temporary fort. It's a small fort, and it was going to be 130 feet square with 6-foot high walls. Okay, so nothing special. It's not like Fort Ticonderoga, or you think about Fort Duquesne, or one of the major forts that you read about in history. This is a small deal. The redoubt was going to have a ditch in front of it. Okay, so this is a very nice little, even though it's quick and dirty, it'll be a pretty good defensive formation, because they knew the British were going to come and attack. So might as well fortify, right? Might as well give yourself as much advantage as you can have. They also built a wall of earth and stone facing the west side of the peninsula. The wall stretched facing the east side. I'm got my stuff mixed up here, but the wall stretched from the north left side of the redoubt to a stone wall on the left or the north side of the peninsula. So again, it may help if you have a map, but imagine this right triangle, and in the very middle approximately is this redoubt, and then you draw a line straight up, or mostly straight up, all the way up to the water where the Mystic River was. So they decided to they have a rail fence at one point, and they have a stone wall part of the way. So they're taking advantage of whatever natural stuff they can to fortify their position. All right, so the British, they open up a cannonade. They fire cannonballs at them, both from ships as well as from land, and they were mostly ineffective. But despite this, many militiamen left the hill to return home. And by the next day, the American force in the redoubt was down to about 500 or 600. And that's one of the things that always amazes me, Scott, about the Revolutionary War, is just people just going home.
Yeah, there's no hanging for desertion or anything like that. Or maybe there is. I don't know how.
Well, there will be later. Yeah, there will be when they get more organized. But that's the thing about militia. It's a volunteer force. So, you know, if you want to fight, fine. If not, that's fine, too.
Just go back to the Elks Lodge and you're good.
Yeah, no kidding. Time for another beer. One colonial commander, a man named Israel Putnam, summoned reinforcements. And then also you had about 200 men under a couple of colonels named John Stark and James Reed. They arrived and they manned the wall that ran between the redoubt and the Mystic River. So we've got a pretty decent defensive formation that the Patriots have put together here. There was one other reinforcement that arrived, and this is really, at the time, he was very famous. Now, not many people today have heard of him, and we'll see why later. But a man named Joseph Warren, he was a doctor. He was a Patriot leader, friend of John Hancock and Samuel Adams. He had been given the commission of a major general. And so he came up and joined the force that was in the redoubt. And he didn't serve as an officer. You know, the colonel in command, Colonel Prescott, said, "Well, I'll yield command to you. You know, I'm a colonel, you're a general." And General Warren said, "No, I'm just coming to fight. I'm just a volunteer. I don't want to take command." So there you go. They're the Federals. What am I saying? This is not the Civil War. The Patriots are dug in. Some of them are in a redoubt on top of the hill. Some of them are to the left of the redoubt or to the north of the redoubt, but they are at least behind walls or behind a rail fence that they've stuck extra things in to fortify, and they are ready to go.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow up on something that you mentioned two episodes ago when you talked about how British soldiers were equipped versus Patriot soldiers, because this is very important as we get into Bunker Hill and the battle itself and what happens. So you did a very good job detailing this and giving the broad strokes, where your average British soldier had the Brown Bess, the musket, and things were much more scattershot and all over the place for Patriot soldiers. You'd have weapons of all types and descriptions. But the difference between the two, this is important for a charge and an assault, the British had bayonets on their muskets. For the most part, the Patriots did not. A popular firearm that they would have was called the New England Club Musket. This is a gun with a heavy buttstock that it was a good counter to Indian tomahawks. So as being part of a defensive home guard against Indian attacks, it served that purpose. But almost nobody had rifles. They also didn't have much reserve ammunition. And the problem is, it's one thing to be short on ammunition, but when you have all sorts of different caliber weapons, you oftentimes can't find the ammunition that you need for your weapon. You have to cast your own musket ball there on the spot. You have to prepare your own cartridge boxes. So before John Stark and his men are dispatched to Breed's Hill in the morning, Stark gives each man a cup of powder, 15 balls, and a flint. Many of these balls didn't fit into the caliber of the weapons the men were carrying, so they had to recast them to their own muskets. And then the men had to make cartridges, which, because they didn't have cartridge boxes, they stuffed into their pocket. This is very ragtag happening behind the walls that they built up. That's what's happening on the Patriot side. What's happening?
Well, let me add one thing, yeah, too, real quick. I like this story. It's kind of funny. So they had some cannon, not a ton of cannon, but the Patriots did have some cannon inside the redoubt, and they started to put them into position, They were going to point them in the direction they knew the British would be coming from, which would be from the east. But then they realized they didn't build into the readout any slots to put the cannon barrel through, right? So there's no, I don't know what the technical term is for it, but there's no way for them to shoot the cannon through the walls because there's no holes, right? So they just decided, well, let's just make some holes. So they loaded up the cannons and just blasted it right at the wall, and it just punched right through. And so they made their own holes.
Hey, it didn't crumble. Good job, boys. That's good masonry.
Good old American ingenuity. It's like typical military. I shouldn't say that. Forgive me, but typical. We forgot to put the holes in. All right, well, we'll just blast them through. I like that.
Yeah, that sounds like that ad hoc thing. It sounds like what Russians would do at the Siege of Leningrad, but necessity is the mother of invention. All right, the British.
What's
their plan?
They're going to challenge this reinforcement. They know that the Patriots have put a bunch of men up on Breed's Hill, and they didn't know the readout was going to be built, but it was mainly built overnight. So they woke up the next day and lo and behold, oh, look, great. It's a readout. So they've got to challenge that. So General Gage, he called a council of his senior commanders. And we may remember that last time we talked about three other generals had been sent over, major generals. That's a 2-star, at least, well, by in today's army, it's a 2-star general. Gage was a lieutenant general, which is the equivalent of a 3-star general. So he's the head honcho. But these other guys are under him. He's got Henry Clinton. He's got John Burgoyne, and he's got William Howe, and all those are going to have a big future. We will have a lot to say about every one of them. So he gets them to give their advice. Clinton wanted to seize the neck of the peninsula. In other words, he said, let's go land troops right at the neck and cut these guys off from behind. Okay. And that way, if you think of the, I'm going to change analogies here, Scott, but if you think of the Charlestown Peninsula as a bottle, this would be the neck. And if we cut that off, then the guys in the bottle are going to be stuck. But Gage said, no, we don't want to do that. What if they send over more guys from the mainland? You'll be putting yourself between two groups of rebel or patriot soldiers. They obviously, the British didn't call them patriots. They called them rebels. But so Gage doesn't want to do that. And General Howe says, let's land people on, and some Marines too, Semper Fi, on the Charlestown Peninsula. In other words, let's do the amphibious assault. Let's land on the far end, meaning the east end, and then let's just march up there from behind on the readout. In other words, Howe wanted to do one of those famous flanking movements that Scott loves so much.
Oh, yeah. Battle of Cannae, Khalid ibn al-Walid, so many in history to choose from.
Absolutely, yeah, and these guys had read about them. Let's go around the redoubt. Instead of hitting it head on, let's go around it and let's hit it from behind as well as from the front, and we'll just completely cut off the Americans and surround them. Gage said, okay, I like that idea. So he agrees to that, and he wanted to show – Gage didn't want to just capture the redoubt and capture the peninsula. He wanted to send a message to the Americans. He wanted – to show that no mere, dirty, half, poor, unprofessional American militiamen could resist British regulars. We're professional soldiers. You guys are amateurs. You guys are a bunch of farmers with guns. He wanted to show them who was boss and to strike fear into their hearts. So what if they're inside of a fortification? No big deal. We'll go through it.
Yeah, and this is an attitude that, looking back in history, we can fault the British for, of underestimating the Patriots. It's easy, I think, to be an armchair general and say, oh, he was egotistical. His hubris got the best of him. He overruled Clinton, who wanted to dig in. I can sort of see where Gage is going, because a siege is hard work. To lay the entire peninsula, it's a siege. You could be attacked on both sides. Many times it's just as hard laying the siege as it is being under siege itself. But at the same time, this lesson in history of not underestimating your opponent goes all the way back to Sun Tzu. And this is it in spades, where it's not just the strategy of flanking them. And I respect a good flank. You mentioned all these people, and you know who else liked flanking? Napoleon. So I respect that. But then digging deeper into the strategy, there wasn't really any complicated maneuvering once they did this flanking maneuver. They thought, well, we'll charge the hill. The slope is gentle. if we have a determined assault and then bayonet them, we're going to capture the fort. This idea of Gage is that this will demonstrate that the British army can crush any rebel insurrection. Some may have even thought the Americans were cowards and all they had to do was just chase them down when they went into a full rout.
Yeah, they'll break and run.
Right. And this same attitude that's repeated other times in the war. Well, we saw it with Lexington and Concord, and this cripples British generals throughout the war. I mean, on the one hand, I get that if you're running a colonial empire all around the world and you have limited troops you can send abroad, you really want to crush uprisings ruthlessly to send a message elsewhere. But this idea of underestimating your opponent, it's one thing at the beginning of the war, but this seems to persist. And it's one of the things that cripples the British war machine, or not the war machine, but the leadership. So I sympathize with the troops on the ground who had to keep following these orders that get them blundering into bad situations. It's almost like Confederate generals that get a little bit intoxicated on the spirit of Johnny Reb and the chivalric spirit that will allow them to overcome any odds and anything else. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Yeah, one rebel is as good as 10 Yankees. Yeah, that turned out to not be the case. All right, so the British begin to get ready. They start loading up the soldiers into boats on the docks of Boston. Around 2 p.m., or actually it was at before 2 p.m., they started moving over. By 2 p.m., the last of about 1,600 British troops landed on the peninsula at Moulton's Point, which is the southeast corner of the peninsula. Now, while this is going on, it's not southeast. I'm sorry. It's just like east. It's one of the angles of the triangle, if you will. So, but as they're landing, snipers in Charlestown, which again, that's on the right angle. It's the part closest to Boston. Snipers in Charlestown are starting to fire at some of these soldiers. And so the British realize, well, we got to get rid of these snipers. We can't do an attack if people are picking off a bunch of our guys. So, some of the British ships that were in the Charles River began firing away on Charlestown. So they blast away at the town and most of the things catch on fire. Most of the buildings are made out of wood and pretty soon the entire town is in flames. And so keep that in mind as we talk about the battle and next time that there's smoke everywhere and it's really creating chaos, fire and smoke, and it's adding to the heat. It's already a very hot day. And so that's going to make things really interesting. Before the British actually start the assault on the redoubt and on the other American lines, Howe realizes that he needs more soldiers. So he summons about 700 more reinforcements from Boston. And he had the original force rest until reinforcements could arrive. And that gave the Americans a little bit more time to prepare, or the Patriots. So there you go. That's where we stand right before the attack. The British are lining up, getting ready, and the Americans are getting ready as well.
So let's give the British command credit here. They're not repeating the mistakes of Lexington and Concord. They're having troops that are well-rested and in good number, so they can accomplish the task. So, hey, let's give them that, right?
Right. Definitely don't want to make that mistake again.
Yes, they narrowly avoided disaster. If it weren't for poor Patriot marksmanship and disorganization, then Lexington and Concord could have been a lot uglier for the British. But we are going to get into the thick of Bunker Hill. But this is such a big topic. We can't put this in one episode. And what we have to do is leave this with a cliffhanger, like any good two-parter, you know. But we're not going to do Dallas in the 1980s of who shot JR and have you wait the entire summer. If you're listening to this digitally, it's probably just the next episode over. So we are going to pick up in the next episode and see what happens when we get into the Battle of Bunker Hill. See you then. So that is the episode for today. As always, I want to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, especially our spy masters, Todd Warren, Jake Harrington, Beverly Ingle, Bill Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Baron Fraza, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, Moondoggy from Ohio, Rick Knowlton, Vic and Irene, Mike from New York, Michelle, and Marlene. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.